Good evening, and you are most welcome to this week's episode of Let's Go Green. I'm your host, Aisling O'Rourke, and each and every week we try and give you tips and tricks on how you can do your bit for the environment to help us all do our bit to tackle climate change without lecturing you. And I hope you are safe and well as you tune in this week. And, you know, I know we're nearing the end of summer, but like it's a nice time of year to be thinking about maybe refreshing our look at what we are doing and the practices that we have in our own homes. Well, unless you've been under a rock, you will know that the government has been negotiating over the course of this summer and indeed this year with all the industries and various sectors across Ireland on how they can do their bit to cut their carbon emissions. Now, over the summer, the government announced that it had reached an agreement, and the idea is that we are going to significantly cut our emissions here in Ireland. We saw with the farmers, the agricultural sector, they've been asked to cut their emissions by 25%, and other sectors have been asked to do likewise. But now that the agreement has been reached, what does that actually mean? You know, are we as consumers going to be noticing changes? What are these targets that each sector is going to have to reach? It all sounds very abstract. So to talk to us now about what this all means in practicalities, we're joined by Marie Donnelly. And Marie is the chairperson of the Climate Change Advisory Council. Marie, thank you very much for joining us here on Midlands 103.
Thank you very much indeed, Aisling. Delighted to have this conversation with you.
Now, Marie, I know most of this summer the media attention has been on very much on the agricultural sector, it has to be said. But this agreement, you know, what does it mean in a nutshell for us as a nation? What is it that the government was trying to achieve?
So Ireland, as indeed every other country in the world, is already starting to feel the very really negative impacts of climate change. We've seen it in the heat wave, we've seen it in the storms, we've seen it in the floods. And as part of the global agreement, the Paris Agreement, there is now an attempt to reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases, because they're like an electric blanket on the world. It keeps us warm, and it is much of the cause of these climate changes. So there's this international agreement, Ireland is part of it, to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. Ireland has said, yes, we're going to do our bit. We adopted legislation last year. We said we're going to reduce our emissions by 51%. By 2030, and we're going to achieve that in a measured way, in a structured way. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to reduce it back from 2030 to five-year budgets, because it's easier to understand if it's, you know, directly in a five-year period. So we've set a limit to how much emissions we can have in the first 5 years, which is 2021 to 2025, and then for the second 5 years, 26 to 30. And then that amount, so it was 295 and 200, and then the government said, well, you know, we really need to bring it down to even a smaller bite-sized piece, so that each of the sectors has their own individual challenge that they can work towards. And that's what the sectoral ceiling was. So they took the carbon budget of 295 and then allocated that across each of the sectors, so that each sector knew what was the maximum emissions they could make in the next 5 years. So that's what the sectoral ceiling was. The idea is, instead of having, you know, a very broad high-level target, you break it down both in terms of time and in terms of sector, so it becomes more manageable to actually achieve the results of reducing emissions.
And, like, maybe I'm being unfair, but so far, anything that I've read around it really seems to be targeted at actually reaching the agreement. I've had trouble finding a roadmap or a plan as to what this means in concrete terms.
Well, part of the whole process, because in fact it's a whole procedure really that's been set up, is that, okay, you have your objectives in the legislation, then we have our five-year carbon budgets, then the sectors get their piece. But the really important part is what we call the Climate Action Plan. This is a document produced by the government, and they did one in 2021, and they now have to update it at the end of this year. It's a document that sets out sector by sector the precise actions and measures that will be taken in order to reduce emissions. So, for example, if you take in the electricity space, where the target is actually very high, it sets out precisely what our renewable generation capacity needs to be in order to reduce our electricity from electricity down to 80%. And that, you know, in this you have things like, you know, rollout of wind farms, you have solar panels on all of our roofs, for example, you have offshore wind. And then you have, alongside that, measures for us as individuals in the electricity space. So a good example of that would be the rollout of smart meters, so that we as consumers can make a choice to use electricity when it is cheapest and also most plentiful. And that helps to reduce emissions on an ongoing basis.
Now, this is purely anecdotal, but I was I give myself an afternoon over every July, because that's when my contracts expire, to ring around my different providers, whether it be broadband or electricity, to see can I get a discount for the following year. And I did ask about a smart meter. I'm with Energia, and I was told over the phone, oh, no. Well, you'd have to pay €200 for the smart meter, and then the cost of your electricity will be more expensive. Now, like, I think you're mentioning solar panels there, and I'd be quite honest, if I had the money to put solar panels across the roof of my apartment building, I'd do it in a heartbeat. But like many people, to make these measures, it does come down to brass tacks. And with the cost of living crisis, as much as we want to do our bit, we might not have the finances to do it. So is there anything in this agreement that looks at giving individual householders some help to make these changes?
Yes, there are. And in fact, I'm very happy that you mentioned the issue of smart meters. It's something of a hobby horse of my own, I must say. at the moment, ESB networks are rolling out smart meters, approximately 10,000 a week, which is a lot. Not enough, of course, but mm-hmm. it's a lot. Mm-hmm. And they're being rolled out for free. So you shouldn't have to pay for your smart meter. It's part and parcel of the national rollout of smart meters. Now, of course, it's like the national broadband. You know, they're doing it bit by bit. So I suppose if you jump the queue, maybe you can pay to get it earlier. But it will come to you and it will be free. So that's a very important issue. The second thing is, it's not true to say that your electricity will be more expensive. When you have a smart meter, you have a choice, and I think this is very important. It's your choice. You can then look at your energy supplier and look at the various tariffs that they offer. You can stay on the one you've always been on if that's what you want, or you can move to what they call a time of use tariff. And that allows you to vary the price that you pay for the electricity depending on the time that you use it. And probably the simplest way to put this is that electricity between, say, 4 o'clock and 7 o'clock is expensive because everybody wants electricity at that time. It's like the Ryanair flights. You know, if you happen to book in the middle of July when everybody else is traveling, mm-hmm. it's going to cost you more. So electricity, likewise, between 4 and 7 is expensive. Electricity between 2 and 4 o'clock in the morning is almost for free. So the issue there is that if you can manage your electricity consumption, for example, you program your dishwasher and indeed your washing machine to come on in the middle of the night, and a lot of the new machines have a time delay that allow you to do that, then you're using that electricity in the middle of the night and it's really cheap. But of course, if you use it between 4 and 7, then it's expensive. So when you go on, if you choose to go on a time of use tariff, you have to think about how you use your electricity so that you can get the maximum savings. So it does take a little bit of effort, but you've already started in a very positive way by looking at your contract every year. And that's a very good practice. And it's certainly one I would recommend for people to do.
Well, and obviously this is just my experience of it, but in the course of an afternoon of a couple of phone calls, I managed to save myself €100 a month. So like you, I would recommend that listeners do give it a go. And I know it's nice to have the luxury of an afternoon to myself to do it, but it is worthwhile. Now, Marie, we will continue this conversation, but we just have to take a quick pause to pay the bills and take an ad break. But we will be back with Marie Donnelly of the Climate Advisory Council. Marie is the chairperson chairperson of that council after these short ads. You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, and this evening we are joined by the chairperson of the Climate Advisory Council, Marie Donnelly. Marie, we've been talking in the main about the changes in electricity around this new agreement that the government has reached on emissions. Now, being here in the Midlands, we are a rural area. We do have large town centres, it has to be said, but in the main, there's a lot of agriculture here in the Midlands. And a lot of the media coverage has been around the agricultural sector and this number, this golden ticket of 25% that farmers are being asked to look at. Now that that has been agreed for farmers on an individual farm basis, what does this agreement mean for them? I know they're being asked to be more efficient, but there have been concerns raised over whether or not they're going to have to cut down on the number of animals that they have on their farms.
So for agriculture, you're right, the sectoral ceiling at the moment is 25%. And in order to deliver that, the Department of Agriculture has already come out with a document which they call Ag Climatise. And that's a listing of the measures to be introduced in farming in Ireland in order to reduce emissions. So some of the examples are, for example, changing the fertiliser used into a protected urea fertiliser, because the emissions from that are much reduced and it's as efficient as all the other fertilisers that are available in the market. So that's one. Protected urea is one. It's a big one that they push. A second one is how slurry is spread and what they call low-emission slurry spreading, where it's not spray plate anymore. It's actually, you know, fed into the ground in the most efficient way and the emissions are considerably reduced. So those are just two illustrations of the kinds of things that they're talking about in Ag Climatise. There are others about, you know, what grass seeds and clovers that you plant, at what levels of nitrogen you put out in your farm, what other issues that you have in terms of efficiency, in terms of your, you know, the genetics of your animals, for example, in order to get the maximum efficiency. So like I was saying that you had this climate action plan published every year, you've similarly got one specifically for agriculture called Ag Climatise, and in it you can see the measures that are proposed by the department in order to reduce the emissions, and indeed that are supported both through the new cap coming down the track, through ACRES, which is the new funding program that's also starting, and through the Thames model and other things that they have available in terms of financial support. So there really is quite a listing of issues there that farmers can avail of and be supported for in terms of reducing their emissions.
The IFA, we spoke to a spokesperson for the IFA on the show last week, and their claim was that, you know, what I was told at least was, no problem putting solar panels on my farm, no problem doing what I can, but if I can't offset that against my carbon emissions, if I can't get carbon credits for it, where's the money, where's the incentive going to come from?
Well, there's two things. Firstly, there will be, and there is already, incentives for farmers, for example, as you say, to put up solar panels. And, of course, the real attraction there is to use that electricity themselves, because then they don't have to buy it in from the grid. So that actually saves them quite a bit of money, not just, for example, in the milking parlour, but also in the house. To use your own electricity is obviously, the cheapest form of electricity that you can get, especially if you can get the solar panels up and the grants to support that. What is going to happen over time, but it will take a few years to do this, is what they call carbon farming and a carbon market, where farmers, you know, over time there will be a baseline set and farmers who save on carbon will be able to trade that for commercial return. But that is going to take a little bit of time because, of course, you firstly have to have a baseline for every farmer and that has to be rolled out. It's going to take a few years to do that. But in those circumstances, then a farmer can say, you know, I started at 100 and now I'm down to 92. I get value for that 8 units that I've saved. So, but that is, as I say, it's going to come in over the next number of years. But already solar panels, using the electricity yourself, on the farm, be it the milking parlour, and in the house, is a very real opportunity that exists for farmers.
I mentioned this when I was speaking to Liam Delaney of the IFA on last week's show. One thing, because like I'm a millennial, I grew up listening to teachers talk about the break in the ozone layer over Australia and like that we were all going to have to make our changes, and seeing as I travelled other countries and their recycling practices. So this, you know, this is not a new issue to me, that this idea that we have to do our bit for the environment. But the one thing that Liam Delaney did mention in relation to the size of farming, and I was wondering about the milk quotas and the scrapping of milk quotas. And we saw here in Ireland this upsurge in the size of dairy farms. The minute farmers were allowed increase their herd, they did, they invested. They're now in a situation where they have invested an awful lot of money and have taken on debt as a result. And the fear is there that, well, they're going to have to undo that. So I'm wondering, Maureen, you might be able to, you're much more learned on this topic than I am. Was it a mistake to scrap the milk quotas?
I don't think so. I mean, the milk quotas was basically brought in terms of global milk prices and, you know, exporting to the global market at a competitive price. The rationale that's in existence at the moment is we need sustainably produced food. Mm-hmm. And Irish agriculture is already ahead of the posse on that one, because we're very fortunate to have grass-fed cattle in Ireland, which is already a sustainable path forward. Yes, we do have to tinker at the edges. Yes, we have to look at specifics, like I mentioned, in terms of the fertilizer we use, you know, what we do with the slurry, what is our stocking rate, you know, what is our mechanism in terms of how we feed the animals. Yes, there are edges that we need to look at. But the real issue, and this is the policy objective at the moment, is to say, one, we need to produce sustainable food, and two, we need to get maximum value for the food. So what we're looking at is, yes, maintaining our food supply and our export of it, and moving it up the value chain, so that ultimately the return to farmers is ensured and their income is safeguarded with that process. And it is achievable. It will be step by step. There will be changes for farmers, as indeed for the rest of us. But it is not the objective to damage farmers' income. Rather, the opposite is the case. It's to protect their incomes and actually to supply additional sources of income. And this is why some of the discussion, for example, about solar power and indeed anaerobic digestion, these are, you know, alternative income streams that farmers can take on gradually and to some extent in their farms, which will give further support to their income. So yes, it's a change, but it's not, it doesn't have to be a damaging change. If we manage it properly, it's actually going to be a very positive and a financially rewarding change for farmers.
Do we then have to look at diversifying what we produce here in Ireland? Like, I know there are certain things that we are completely reliant on for imports for, like soybeans. Like, you know, people who, if you like Asian food, you'd be very familiar with maybe going to your local grocery and getting your frozen edamame beans, or even in the takeaway, or getting your tofu. All of that is imported. And like we see with the war in Ukraine this year, the invasion of Ukraine, the effect on grain to being exported around the world. We saw in 2010 the disruption to getting access to certain things because of the ash cloud from that volcano in Iceland that erupted, that I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce. You know, we've had periods of time where the transport of food and, say, fertilizer has been disrupted. So do we need to become in certain areas a bit more self-efficient? Like, is there an opportunity for farming here to maybe look at what we're importing and thinking, hold on a second, we could actually be growing this ourselves?
Yes, indeed, that is absolutely the case. And that's actually one of the areas that Chagas is currently examining, to see to what extent we can further make our food supply resilient. But of course, remember, we're part of the European Union. And in that context, we are a European Union food market, because we have mutual support of each other in terms of trading between what we supply from Ireland, what we get, for example, from Spain, what comes from Germany. So we are a rather big food producing market region in the world, and we are part of that market. You're right that globally, two things are happening. One, climate change itself is impacting the world. I mean, I've just read this morning about in Mexico about the drought. 48% of Mexico is in a drought. This is having a hugely negative impact on their capacity to produce food locally of any kind. It's the same in other parts of the world where, you know, in Africa and indeed in Asia, where either you have massive floods or you have droughts and they're not able to produce the food that they need themselves. So climate change is impacting the global capacity to produce food. Europe is perhaps fortunate in that we are well balanced in terms of food production, but climate change is having a negative impact across the world. And then, of course, you have disruptions. You're quite right to point out Ukraine, the supply of grain from Ukraine, supply of other things globally being affected by supply chains and the lack of availability of ships and other things like that. It is an issue, but climate change itself is at the root of a lot of the problems of food shortages in the world, and that's really why we have to be very focused on what we do in climate change. And if I could just jump for a moment, Aisling, to specifically what do we do in Ireland? I mean, in Ireland, two-thirds of our emissions come from fossil fuels. That's, you know, the oil, the petrol, the diesel that we use either in our home heating systems, for example, or in our cars and transport. And two-thirds of our emissions come from there. And, you know, we really need to focus on getting off fossil fuels, not least because it's costing so much money at the moment, but because it's where the emissions are coming from. And, you were saying, what can people do? Just like you do your check on your electricity once a year. For example, we're now coming into the winter. If people have an oil boiler, how old is it? When was it last serviced? Because if it's not serviced regularly, it's not as efficient as it could be, and therefore it's costing them money. If it's more than about 10 or 12 years, oof, it's getting close to the end of life. Possibly time to start thinking about, you know, what am I going to change to when the boiler needs to be replaced? Can I use that opportunity to go, for example, for a heat pump, and what would be involved, and can I start planning now? So these are kind of practical things that people can do in their own home about, you know, firstly getting the efficiency out of the oil boiler if they have one, and secondly, planning now for its replacement rather than, you know, can you imagine Christmas Eve, the boiler breaks down and then you're stuck, what are you going to do? So that's one area that's very relevant in the Irish context, because we have 1.1 million homes in Ireland that have an oil heating system at home. And maybe we're not as efficient as we should be on getting the servicing done and thinking about what happens when it breaks down. Can we change to another heating system, and can we prepare for that right now?
And my family home, it's heated by oil, central heated, and the boiler gets serviced. And we're very lucky to have a very, very good plumber. But, you know, it does get serviced regularly. In fact, the pump that's sitting there now at the moment was only put in 2018. So I absolutely understand where you're coming from. But even if you just take my own family home, it would cost thousands to switch it over to a heat pump. And that's, I suppose, I think there's an awful lot of people listening to this programme, to programmes like mine, who genuinely want to make a change, but they don't have the money to do it. And it strikes me that we need government grants of 20, 30, 40, 50,000 into each home in the country to actually be able to make these changes that people are willing to make.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, even though this year now the grants were increased considerably, it's about 6,500 of a grant for your heat pump. But there is more on top of that, because if you get the heat controls and whatever, which are also available for grant support, it can come to about 8,000 or 9,000 as a support. But of course, you're absolutely right. It will cost you some money. And the second part, which is absolutely key in that context, is to ensure that should you make a decision to make a shift, yes, you get the grant, and that's very important, but equally important that you have somebody who can advise you. This is what the one-stop shops are about, that you can go to a one-stop shop who'll say, yes, this is your house, this is what you need to do, this is what it's going to cost, this is how you can do it, and these are the grants, and we'll manage the paperwork for you. And whatever doesn't get covered by a grant, that there is low-cost financing available, and that's the key element that's coming through now. That's urgent, so that you can get long-term, really low-cost finance for the difference that isn't covered by the grant. So this is a rollout that's coming through in the autumn of this year. It's an essential part in order to support people to make the switch. I think it will make a difference. But if I could just on that one say, you know, it's kind of like steps of the stairs, Aisling. There are things you can do right now today and coming into winter are very important that are really very cheap and are funded at a very high rate. Classic example is how much insulation have you got in your attic? I mean, whatever you have there, double it. You get an 80% grant. It's actually very low cost. You're talking about maybe a few hundred euros. It makes a huge difference to keeping the house warm in the wintertime. Look at your front door, your back door. Have you got a draft coming from them? You know, classic example, close the door, put a candle in front of it. If the flame is moving, you've got a draft. Put draft sealer around your door. It's, you know, tens of euros to do that. Seal the house in that context. Look at your windows. Again, the candle, are there drafts coming from your windows? Can you seal the draft? So really low cost, but, you know, simple measures that you can do right now that will make a difference coming into this winter. And as you quite rightly say then, planning for the bigger expenditures, getting the information from the one-stop shop, getting the knowledge from them as to what needs to be done, where you can get the grants, how much it's going to be, what low-cost finance is there, and can you get people to come and schedule the work in your house? Hmm. So kind of a short term right now before winter, and then, you know, a longer term planning for the change coming down the track.
Well, Marie Donnelly, thank you so much for all those tips. We should say, of course, never leave a candle unattended, as much as we do enjoy you trying out that particular tip there. But Marie Donnelly, thank you very much for joining us on Let's Go Green this week. Marie is, of course, the chairperson of the Climate Advisory Council, and I really appreciate you being so generous with your time.
Thank you very much indeed.
We will be back after. You're listening to Let's Go Green here on Midlands 103, and I hope you have enjoyed our conversation so far this evening. Well, we're going to turn to waste, and a very specific type of waste, and that is medical waste and all the packaging that comes with medication, medical equipment, all of that stuff, even face masks, I guess. We're joined now by a man called Rogers Wallachira. Rogers, you are most welcome to Let's Go Green.
Thanks very much, Aisling. Thanks for having me.
Now, Rogers, I kind of gave our listeners a little bit of insight into this, but like when we think about medical equipment and medicine, we think, you know, oh God, you know, if you need it, you need it, and that's it. But from an environmental perspective, you know, we're assessing everything nowadays. We're becoming more and more aware of the impact that we're having. And I know you have really focused in on this issue of packaging around the medical sector. Can you talk to me about how you got here?
Thanks very much, Aisling, for having me, and good evening, listeners. Yeah, so my name is Rogers Wallachira, and I'm originally from Uganda. It's a small East African country. And as we all know, climate change does to have an awful lot of impact in, you know, for developing countries. So I've seen firsthand the impact of climate change, and I guess that was first the reason as to why I went into all this. But also the fact that I work in the medical device industry, and I'm currently working in the pharmaceutical. I've worked for both the medical and pharmaceutical industry. I could see an awful lot of waste that we generate within the industry. And as we all know, as you've said there, you've alluded to it, that it is that increased demand for environmentally benign goods, you know, and medical devices, you know, are not an exception. But what we are facing is that lack of knowledge, or if you like, the technical know-how on how to go about cutting down on our waste. So I was compelled, and I said, look, I set out to do a research, and my research is now focused on evaluating the environmental effect that is caused by the packaging materials that we use in the medical device and the pharmaceutical industries.
Okay.
Yeah, so I guess that's the ground reason as to why I went into this research, because as I say, design for the environment, you know, should be at the forefront of every single company or medical device company out there, but it isn't, because first, designers haven't been taught or do not have the tools to do it. And secondly, you see, packaging for us serves in the medical device industry serves a very one of the primary reasons as to why we have packaging is, you know, we have devices that need to be sterile when they reach the hospital, right?
Exactly,
so
yeah.
We need to maintain our the sterility of our devices. So what you find is, even though some of the engineers out there, medical device designers, want to do it, but they don't have the tools, but they don't know, they don't have the tools, and also they don't know the effects of the climate at the moment. So it's an issue that has to be highlighted.
So Rogers, this has become your area of research, as you said, like inspired by seeing firsthand from your home country the effects of climate change. You're now actually, well, doing something about it. Instead of just seeing the effects and worrying about it, you're taking action in relation to it. And like, I know, like, I have been involved in the care of members of my family when they've been unwell. I'm type 1 diabetic. I use an insulin pump system. And every couple of days, I have to change that out. And every little bit of that, well, it's all made from plastic. The whole kit is made from plastic. But every little bit that I use every couple of days, it's wrapped in plastic as well. And I have no way of really getting rid of that, only putting it in the waste. And I'm just one type 1 diabetic person on an insulin pump system. There are thousands of us around the world. Yes. So I suppose this is an issue that has been on my mind over the last while. And I'm really curious as to the fact that you're researching it, that somebody is looking into this, because it kind of seems a bit obvious to me because it's part of my day-to-day life. And I wonder, Roger, are you hoping that out of your research, you might find a way of getting around these issues? Like you mentioned, the sterilization, making sure everything's hygienic, which obviously we want all medical equipment to be safe and sterile. Is there a light at the end of the tunnel here at all?
Absolutely. And thanks for that question. There is, because I'll tell you, it's got to start with countries legislating for it.
Okay.
Because at the moment, what we have is you know, for every company you know out there has an EHS, you know, manager or policy, whatever, but they don't have the regulations. They don't really care so much about the environment. But if the regulation is clear, right, and it calls out that, look, you cannot have so much waste. You can, you know, when you have your product designed the way, you have to kind of cut back, because majority of the waste, as you say, there is just to keep the product, but it's not really needed. You know, the product will be safe regardless. And I'll give you an example. Singapore at the moment has a program called mandatory reporting program, whereby for every single product that is being imported into the country has to show a sustainability, sustainability program in place. You have to show, okay, this is the amount of waste I'm bringing into the country at the moment. But 5 years down the road or 2 years down the road, I intend to cut this down. Until when the government or people like yourself and myself come out and advocate for this, that we need to have a legislation in place for the devices that we put out there to cut on the plastic waste that we produce as manufacturers.
Playing devil's advocate, we are very afraid in Ireland because of the crash in 2007-2008 of losing foreign direct investment. So the likes of Pfizer, Intel, we lost Dell, you know, Medtronic, all of those pharma companies in particular, but the medical device companies that are based in Ireland, there is a fear, I think, in government that if we do anything to impede their work,
yes,
but they might decide to look elsewhere and pull out. Is there political will to encourage medical device companies and pharma to do something about the wastage that they're producing?
And that might not, the political will might not be there, but you see, it has got to be forced. Mm-hmm. You see, every single company has what they call a quality policy. And what it is, they say, okay, we are going to save lives, because that's at the core front of every single medical and pharmaceutical company, is saving people's lives. But we have to be we have to be direct about it and say, look, you're saving lives, but are we saving lives here and taking more lives? We've all seen now what's happening in France. We've seen what's happening in many, many countries, even in Britain. But the political will only come when there's enough pressure out there, okay? Because at the end of the day, it's not about just jobs. It's about your livelihood. It's about, you know, caring for the environment. It's not good enough to have millions when you don't, you know, when the environment is going to be destroyed, or, you know, we won't be here, you know? So, but we can engage companies. We can engage companies. We need to see more investment in terms of sustainability. This has to be a conversation brought about, you know, brought on the table to the engineers. Those of us that are in design, you know, for all those that are making those in production, management, and of course, government. Government has got to be in it. We don't have to bring the, you know, start bashing medical devices or rather medical device companies, but we can bring a conversation. But at the moment, there's no conversation there, you see.
Yeah.
There's no research. If you to look anywhere, there's no literature to support this argument. So we need to have as more researchers, we need to have government on side. We're not trying to send away jobs here, because I work in the sector, and I don't want to turn into a whistleblower, but I just want to be there. We're trying to see what we can do as engineers, as medical device designers, management, everyone in on it, not just a question of, oh, farmers emit so much carbon there, or you know, everyone getting what you call it electric cars. Every single industry has to go to lift its own weight. And for me, well, if I can do that.
Rogers, thank you so much for getting in contact with me. I'm here. As I said, it's an interest. It's a topic that I have a personal interest in, but I think it's one that's very interesting. And I think we might look back to chat with you again, perhaps when you have some results from your research project. As Roger mentioned to me, off air, things move a little bit faster in broadcasting than they do in the medical device and pharmaceutical companies. But you might keep in touch with us, Rogers, and let us know how the project is continuing.
Listen, Ashin, thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you to my contributors for this week's episode of Let's Go Green. And just a quick reminder, if you would like to share this episode with your friends and colleagues, you can do so on Spotify, Google Podcasts, and of course, Apple Podcasts. Just search Let's Go Green in your preferred podcast app. I'll be back same time next week with another episode of the show. But for now, stay safe and have a great week.